appreciate the invitation to be here tonight. I appreciate the work the congregation is doing in this lectureship and for the fact that the elders here and the members here have decided that this series of discussions is worthwhile. I think it's very important. A lot of the reasons we could talk about for it being so important, Bruce discussed this morning, but it is essential that you and I understand why we believe what we claim to believe. And it's becoming more and more important that we be able to express to other people some of the foundational concepts and principles that perhaps in years gone by would have just been assumed that most people agreed with. And yet we're living in a society today, especially as our children are growing up, in which I think our faith in God is very much a minority. It's wonderful to be here with you. I'm so glad to be able to come from Texas and be here, spend time with Bruce and with Shane and with Tyler. And I'm going to tell you something, and you can decide if it's true or not. All we're going to do is study the Bible all week when we're together. We won't laugh or cut up or have any kind of fun at all. But I tell you, that's one of the great things about being able to be involved in a week like this, is be around people of like mind and like faith and just kind of enjoy yourself. I want to tell you at the very outset, we're going to talk about the resurrection of Jesus Christ tonight. I am not going to preach the sermon that you have heard over and over and over about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I'm not going to spend much time talking about whether or not Jesus truly died. I'm not going to spend much time talking about disciples possibly hiding bodies. You've heard that sermon. If you haven't, I know Bruce has preached it because I borrowed from his outline to preach the series I did on it. So if you want to hear his or mine, I'm sure you can find those. And I know there have been many capable preachers do that. I think that's valid. I think that's valid. And we'll get to some of that in just a moment. But what I came to realize as I was preparing for this lesson is that atheists really could not care less about whether or not you think Jesus really died. The atheists really could not care less about some argument about disciples hiding bodies. As a matter of fact, I really think that when the skeptic launches those particular arguments, what they are doing is distracting us from what they're truly saying. And so that's what I want to talk about with you this evening. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is the central doctrine of the New Testament. In the resurrection, we see the final fulfillment of many of the Old Testament prophecies. We see the foundation and the basis for the very hope that we have. It is because Jesus was raised from the dead that the serpent's head was truly bruised. You and I can have hope in eternal life because the Lamb that was slain is now standing. And while that handwriting of ordinances was nailed to the cross, without the resurrection, there is no king on the throne. The conviction that we have, the power behind that faith, is seen and demonstrated in the resurrection. I don't know of any doctrine that should be closer to the heart of a Christian in this day and age than the resurrection doctrine. It encapsulates everything that you and I must be living this life in order to participate in. It is so important. And then you begin to think about the skeptic or the atheist view of the resurrection. And I honestly don't know if there's a more despicable concept in their mind than this idea that there was a man who died, who lay dead for 3 days, and who came back to life. It undoes, if it is true, so many of the core presuppositions that atheism rests upon. They would tell us that this life is just this life, that there's nothing more to you or I than the atoms and the molecules that make up our physical structure. If that is true, then the resurrection cannot be. But if the resurrection occurred, then clearly there was something that was still preserved even though that body lay in that grave. Peter's definition of death, the separation of body and soul, begins to make sense. It is seen as being logical. The resurrection demonstrates the interaction of a divine being, a wise, intelligent, creative force interacting directly in this world. So much of what the atheist writes about and talks about today ridicules the existence of God by simply saying, if He's there, why doesn't He do something? He gave life to the dead. And they hate that fact. They hate that fact. And so I think this is a topic that's important for you and me to be able to talk to people about. And especially, I think, for those that are interacting on a regular basis with those that are skeptical, or maybe with those that have just made up their mind, there is no God, there can be no God. I think we need to be prepared to meet them where they're at. And I promise you, they're not sitting outside the tomb wondering if there were really soldiers there. As a matter of fact, what you begin to find out as you begin to think about the atheist claims against the resurrection is that they simply do not consider the resurrection of Jesus Christ as a historical event. In other words, they would tell us that historical research is completely out of bounds when it begins to deal with the question of did Jesus rise from the dead. Now, that may not be something you're familiar with hearing. Someone at home asked me what I was preaching on, and I told them, and he said, "What is the historicity of the resurrection?" And I said, "Well, we're primarily going to talk about whether or not you can view the resurrection as a historical event. The atheists say you can't." And he said, "Sean, none of that makes any sense. That's what every preacher wants to hear about the sermon he's about to preach, I assure you." He said, I don't understand why someone would make that argument." Well, of course we don't. Because that reality, that fact, is a core part of who we are. And so much of our faith is built upon it. Of course, we assume that you can examine that and look at the evidence, but the atheists would say that's just not the case. We're going to talk about that tonight. I think there are a couple of other questions that we've got to ask when we begin to discuss the resurrection. I think it is fair, once we've answered this question, can it be treated as a historical event? Then the next logical question in my mind is there enough evidence to call someone who is reasonable to believe in the resurrection? Is there enough out there that suggests that something, and I think we would all have to admit, that the resurrection is a somewhat unique concept, that the idea that someone who is dead is no longer dead after that length of time is certainly outside of our normal experience, and certainly you're going to have to show me a lot of evidence to persuade me that that is so. Is there enough evidence to say this is the most likely understanding of what took place? And then I think it's very important for you and me to kind of sit back and say, so what? I mean, again, it means a lot to me, but what does it mean to the skeptic? Why should it mean anything to the atheist? And I think we do need to spend a little bit of time in trying to answer that question, at least briefly, this evening. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about this idea that the resurrection cannot be considered as a historical event. The argument that many of the new atheists that are writing and speaking today would make. They're basing that upon a concept that was put forth in the 1700s by a Scottish philosopher named David Hume. And David Hume said, "No testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish." Now, that's a convoluted way of saying I don't believe miracles happen because I don't believe miracles happen. That is essentially what David Hume is saying. And C.S. Lewis kind of picked this argument apart and he said, you know, David Hume's exactly right. If miracles never occurred, then miracles never occurred. But that's really all that David Hume is saying in this. And I think it is important when we're listening to these arguments that are often presented in very sophisticated language by those who want to make us feel as if our real problem is a lack of education, that we actually listen to what they're saying and take the time to unwind it. And friends, if you don't know how to unwind it, call somebody that does. Because most, if not all, of these arguments that they present, once you begin to dissect what the argument actually says, is nowhere near as sophisticated as the language would lead you to believe. And if you don't get anything else tonight, I hope you'll at least get that. Please don't tune me out because I said that, but I hope you'll at least get that. Now, David Hume, he based this on what he called his understanding of the unalterable laws of nature. In other words, we look at the laws of nature and those laws don't change. And since we can identify and understand and recognize those laws of nature, and I can take something like a dead man coming back to life and I can say that's outside of the laws of nature, I can therefore assume or know that a resurrection cannot happen. Therefore, any testimony, evidence, or anything else that suggests someone was raised from the dead is not valid. It's not valid at all. And that's a problem when you begin to look at the skeptic's view, because the resurrection is impossible. Suddenly, no amount of evidence is sufficient to demonstrate that the impossible occurred. And you know, I would agree, if something's truly impossible, then it didn't happen. You know, we talk about this when we talk about the omnipotence of God. People like to say, well, God can do anything. Well, He can't make a round square. That's impossible. That is logically impossible. But I do think I have to sit with David Hume for just a moment and say, no, wait a minute. And don't get me wrong, I believe the resurrection was an event that cannot be explained by natural law. But let me sit with David Hume for just a moment. How do we know? How did he know that that was completely and totally outside of the laws of nature? If that's going to be my basis, then I better be sure. But because that's the line of thinking, what we are told is that all evidence of the resurrection should be ignored. Let me make this as simple as I can. When we talk about swoon theories and hiding bodies and all of these other quibbles that people present about the resurrection, what the atheist hears, I don't care how logical our presentation is, our argumentation is, if we begin there instead of dealing with the possibility or the historicity of the resurrection, what they hear is basically the same thing as an argument about inconsistencies in the Lord of the Rings movies. You see, if something cannot happen, it doesn't matter how logical the way you describe it is, it just can't happen. I got a kick out of some of the memes that went around on the internet right after the last Marvel movie where they were using jokes about who could or could not pick up Thor's hammer. And I heard some people in the foyer after services one day. I thought, man, guys, surely there's something better you can talk about. But they were in a heated debate about whether or not Superman should be able to pick up Thor's hammer. And you guys are saying, well, that's not a very important discussion, is it? No, it's not. But it's the very level that the atheist puts all of our consistent argumentation about these quibbles over the resurrection in. If it couldn't happen, it didn't happen, it doesn't matter how consistent you are in what you say did happen, it still couldn't happen. N.T. Wright makes the point that that mindset is very much a part of what he calls this post-enlightenment worldview. And he talks about this post-enlightenment worldview as being the period in which people have imagined some kind of an analogy, even a correlation between history and the hard sciences. He goes on, he says, in this sense, historical means not only that which can be demonstrated and written, but that which can be demonstrated and written within the post-enlightenment worldview. Let me tell you what he's trying to say there. He's saying there's a worldview that's very prevalent right now. I think it's the very worldview we're actually talking about this whole week, that says, listen, the only way to have true knowledge, to gain true knowledge, is through the scientific method. And if you're not using the scientific method to develop the knowledge that you think you're developing, you're really not developing any true knowledge. So in other words, anything that we're going to look at as true knowledge, useful information, it has to be something that can be repeated and that can be measured and then repeated again and then measured again. We must be able to experiment on it. And if we can't follow through with that scientific method, you can't prove anything. Now, that's causing quite a bit of a stir because that does away with all the humanities. In fact, it does away with all of history. But it's especially damaging when we're trying to talk to people about God, His existence, is it reasonable to believe in God, we're talking about the resurrection, or any other miraculous event. Because those are outliers. Those are things that are not going to continually occur throughout history. Those are things we can't go put in a test tube and measure and see if we can get it to happen again and figure out how it happened. And so what they're trying to do is put all of knowledge in a box and close the lid on that box and essentially say, we don't care if there is a God, He can't get in our box. And what you and I have got to do is show people how closed-minded these ideas truly are. And so the skeptic wants everything to fit in this post-enlightenment worldview in which they can just eliminate outliers. How convenient. The things that challenge me, I don't have to consider. And I really appreciate what Bruce said this morning. You and I can be just as guilty of that as anybody else. And we can't be that way if we're going to convert people in this world. We've got to be willing to consider concepts like we're talking about tonight. You may still be scratching your head saying, why in the world would someone say that about the resurrection? I hope you'll think about it. Because it's important for us to consider the position that they're coming from. Because again, as Rudolf Bultmann put it, speaking of the resurrection, is it not a mythical event, pure and simple? It is not an event of past history. Again, if we don't fight that worldview, if we're not working to tear that paradigm apart, I can read someone the Gospel of Mark or Matthew or Luke or John and I can talk to them about fulfilled prophecies and I can talk to them about consistency between the four authors and I can talk to them about Paul and where he gets that statement, 1 Corinthians 15, and I can talk to them about the conversion of a man like James who was the brother of Jesus but not a believer, and then he sees Jesus and we find out he is a believer. I can talk about those things all day long. And I won't convince a single atheist who says, so what? It's nothing more than a comic book or a movie or any other work of fiction. Maybe a really well-written work of fiction, but a work of fiction all the same. So what you and I have to be willing to do is examine this from their perspective and begin to ask, you know, how do we answer this? And I would suggest to you that once you get your mind around what they're saying, it's really not that hard to see through. And I think this is a powerful reason to use the resurrection in talking to our friends and neighbors and co-workers who may be skeptical, because they're predisposed to believe that you and I are somehow allergic to reason. And that if we were logical people, if we were people who would look at the world in a reasonable way, then we would not believe what we believe and we would rapidly come over to their side of things and everybody would just be happier. That in fact, many of the problems in the world today are caused because people like you and me are just so absolutely illogical. But I'm going to tell you what, this is a conversation that allows you and I to demonstrate that is absolutely not the case. You see, this entire argument that they're making that you cannot consider the resurrection as a historical event because it lies outside the laws of nature and therefore the testimony, the evidence would have to be more miraculous than the event itself is very simply the logical fallacy of begging the question. They're assuming the very thing they have to prove in order to find their position. You see, what they're going to have to do is prove to me that they know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the resurrection is outside of the laws of nature. That they have a full and total and complete grasp of the laws of nature. And that they can demonstrate that this particular event simply cannot happen. And oh, by the way, what about all the other unique events in history? You know, how do we know about George Washington's role in the Revolutionary War? How do we know about any number of events in history that were outliers, that were first-time occurrences, and that really and truly are never repeated again? Should I believe in any of those? You know, there's a phrase we like to use. I know as I've been studying my Bible and talking to people that I look up to as mentors, every now and then I'll make an argument and they'll say, wait a minute, that proves too much. And whatever proves too much proves nothing at all. Wouldn't the other side of that argument be true as well? You know, if something disproves everything, shouldn't I begin to question whether or not that's a legitimate argument? If this particular way of looking at knowledge and understanding eliminates any way to be confident in any historical event, should I listen to that? That sounds a little bit like nonsense to me. That doesn't sound very reasonable. Again, they're assumptions. They're based on their current understanding of natural law. John Warwick Montgomery, in his book, Where is History Going?, makes a very interesting point. He says the universe is no longer a tight, safe, predictable playing field in which we know all the rules. Since Einstein, no modern man has had the right to rule out the possibility of events because of prior knowledge of natural law. And again, I'm not arguing that the resurrection falls within natural law. I'm simply saying if you're going to tell me it's impossible, it could not have happened, I shouldn't even think about it, because it's outside of natural law, then friend, you're going to have to give me the precise parameters of natural law. What is it that simply can't happen? You know, I got to wonder, if I went back and I began to talk to David Hume, he was born in 1711, he died in 1776. I wonder what evidence could be shown to David Hume to prove that men would be able to go into outer space and actually walk on the moon. I'm pretty sure that would have been outside of his firm and unalterable view of natural law. I wonder what he would have thought if I had told him that I can send gigabytes of data across the world wirelessly, that I could take a device out of my pocket, stand in Conway, Arkansas, and speak in real time to my wife and daughter 9 hours away in Amarillo, Texas, hear their voice as their voice, know it was them, and have a long conversation. I wonder what evidence could be presented to a man with his understanding of natural law that would cause him to believe it. Because his argument is, it's very simple. Even if I saw it, I wouldn't believe it. Because I've already decided it's impossible. And I think this is important. Have I said that enough tonight? Let me illustrate why that is. I want you to imagine for just a moment that you got on a blue airplane and you flew to Scotland and you got there in 1750 and you were going to talk to David Hume. And he said, how'd you get here? Well, how much time would you spend arguing about a blue plane before you explain to him how human flight could possibly happen? And I think sometimes that's what we find ourselves doing. And let me back this up. This is what I found myself doing until I was dumb enough to volunteer for this lectureship because I thought I already had this material ready. And then I found out I didn't have any material ready for what we're actually talking about this week. Who cares about arguing with David Hume about the color of the plane? Human flight's the issue. Who cares about what Thomas saw? Can I even look at this with a realistic expectation that it's even possible that it happened? Should I even waste my time examining the evidence? That's the question that we first got to deal with. And that's the place where I believe we absolutely have to begin. But here's what's amazing to me. When you separate the emotion from this argument and you just sit down and you look at what we have and what's been presented and we don't beg the question, we don't use logical fallacies, we just treat this concept of the resurrection like we treat every other thing that we've ever heard, been told, or has been indicated to us might have happened. All of a sudden we find that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is on very solid footing. If I don't begin from the perspective that says it just could not have occurred, and I say, why don't I allow history to indicate to me whether or not it was possible? What I find out is that the resurrection is really no different than any other historical event. You know, there's a problem with history and understanding history and knowing what actually happened and what didn't. Gary Habermas, and I tell you what, if you like to read, this is a really good book to read. He's really explicit in his argumentation. He says, although the historian himself will not be able to participate in the event that has already occurred, he is able to inspect the relevant data, such as the eyewitnesses, written documents, and various other records, structures, or archaeological finds. Why do we believe that there was a man named George Washington and that he was central to some revolutionary war and that that's very much a part of why there's a United States of America today? Why do we believe that? Someone says, well, because there's a United States of America today. Okay. There are billions of people who since 3 days after Jesus walked out of that tomb have been convinced and have modeled their lives because they believe He was resurrected. If the end result is all we need to prove it happened, we're done. But I think we know we need more than that. You know, in the case of any other historical event, it's all the things that were written. It's all the eyewitness testimony. It's all the things that were left behind that can be studied and examined. And you take those things and you compare them and you contrast them and you say, okay, this stands outside of everything else. We're not gonna consider this. But here's a consistent message we find in the evidence. And we follow that evidence where it leads. And we shape our understanding and our view of things based on that evidence. That's all we can do with any historical event. And again, I want to emphasize this. No past event meets the criteria of the post-enlightenment definition of a historical event. If it is not fair to examine the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, it's not fair to examine the historicity of anything else. And I think we need to be prepared to have that conversation, to make that point with our friends, our neighbors, with the skeptics that we might encounter. So what do we do? You know, Habermas, in his book, The Verdict of History, goes through a very interesting and detailed procession. I'll sum it up for you. You gather all the evidence you can gather. You examine that evidence. You know, if all the evidence of any claimed event is contradictory, and if it's obviously inflated, and if there's too much bias put into it, then what the historian does is he begins to question. He may say, you know, there's some rumors that this happened, but we're really not able to be sure. We really can't. We're really not confident that it happened. But as he's looking at that evidence and he sees a consistency of thought, and he sees a lot of corroborating information that surrounds the evidence that he's looking at, then he begins to draw reasonable conclusions from that evidence. And he begins, his confidence that event actually occurred begins to grow. I don't care what past event it is we're talking about. That's exactly how the historian goes about doing his research. Which brings us to our next question. What about the resurrection? Do we even begin to see the resurrection or the historicity of the resurrection meeting that criteria? You know, one of the points that I found, even in those who are very skeptical about the resurrection, one thing none of them really try to deny is that there is an absolute preponderance of evidence. As a matter of fact, some of them argue there's really too much evidence. There's all sorts of evidence. And one of the things you look for are multiple independent sources. You know, if the only evidence that we had of the resurrection came from Peter and John, we might have a good reason to say that might be questionable. Because they were involved in what was going on. They were colluding together, we could say. And we need some independent sources. But when I begin to look at the resurrection, even in the Gospels, what I begin to find out is other people speaking about this event. I mean, the Jewish council gets together and tries to come up with a cover story for what's going on. And other historians, men like Josephus and others, mention these events. We have multiple independent sources that confirm this. We have something very important, the antagonistic witness. You know, if you ask my mom and you ask her if I've done some good thing, my mom's probably going to say yes. Most of the time. Sometimes she gets irritated with me, but most of the time she's gonna be complimentary of me. Why? I'm her son. And she knows that if I look good, it reflects on her, and that's beneficial to both of us. But what about somebody that doesn't like me at all? What about someone who would actually say, you know, I'm kind of an enemy of that guy. I don't care for him at all, but I got to be honest with you. You know, he won't lie to you, or whatever positive statement could be made. You know, kind of like Daniel when the council was trying to find a way to find him at fault. The only way we're going to do it is with his law. Well, that's great antagonistic witness to the character of that man. And you know, when I begin to look at the resurrection, I see a lot of that. I see that with the guard that was placed there. I see that with those who were denying the resurrection. I see that even in the extra-biblical evidence as they're having to write about in Roman history about the persecution of Christians, about putting people to death because of their testimony concerning the cross. It's a powerful, powerful piece of evidence. There are embarrassing admissions. Let me ask you, if you're Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, and you get down and you're talking about the events that take place in the garden just prior to the arrest of Jesus, and there you are, and maybe you're John and you're writing, are you going to write about falling asleep while your dear friend is over there crying his eyes out in obvious stress and pain if you're just wanting to make yourself look good and make up a story? I don't think any of us would do that. Would you then go on to talk about how all of you, yourself included, when the Lord was arrested, that you were afraid and you ran away? If you were trying to build a legend to develop a following, would you talk to everybody about how you demonstrated outright cowardice when you're calling on them to have faith and lay down their life? That really doesn't make sense. These embarrassing admissions are strong testimony and strong evidence. We have eyewitness accounts to the resurrected Christ. Now, one of the little quibbles that the skeptic will throw up, he'll say, well, we don't have any eyewitness accounts to the resurrection. No one claims to have been there in the tomb when Jesus actually revived. And they tell us we can't use logic or reason. A man died. You buried him. He was there for 3 days. And then you and several other people, large groups, small groups, people that knew him intimately, people that didn't, people all over the place, saw him up and walking around for the next 40 days or so. And we can't conclude what happened in the tomb? Give me a break. I thought we were going to reason. We've got several eyewitness accounts of the resurrected Lord. Some we'll look at in just a moment that had no reason, no prior reason to want to deceive or lie about what they saw. We have early testimony regarding those events. And again, these are very powerful concepts, very powerful ideas. Of course, what then happens is we see the witness, the evidence being assaulted. Because after all, the witnesses were biased. In fact, there was too much time, and this is a big one. There was so much time that passed between the resurrection and the rioting. It gave too much time for legend to grow, for a myth to develop. Again, there's no first-hand account of Jesus in the tomb. And the best testimony leads us to infer a resurrection. And I think when someone presents those to us at first, we go, ooh, it kind of sounds bad. I don't know how to overcome those things. Well, Tyler did most of my work for me this morning. He's going to finish up tomorrow. The majority of these statements are actually assaults on the integrity of Scripture. And once you make a strong affirmative argument for the integrity of Scripture, much of this just disappears. We can bundle them up and kind of just throw them away. But you know, as we begin again to compare the evidence for the resurrection to the evidence for everything else, what we find out again is that the resurrection stands on pretty strong footing. What about those biased witnesses? You know, Tacitus is known as the most reliable Roman historian that we have access to today. Gary Habermas states that he was known to have had prejudices such as his aristocratic ideas or bias. And he was known to have a conviction that moralizing was the highest function of writing history. Now, get what he's saying. Our most reliable Roman historian says, I think my job as a historian is to impress my views and my opinions on the history that I'm writing. And if I went into any history class and I began to say, well, we just don't have enough evidence to really know what went on in the Roman Empire prior to Tacitus, that history professor would laugh me out of the room. He'd have nothing to do with me. And yet here's a man whose point, whose goal was not to report, but to shape. It was not to just let us know what happened, but to tell us in a way that really dealt with what he wanted to happen as much as anything else. Now, I come back to the Gospels and I begin to look at them critically. All this time that passed by. Tacitus and Livy, they wrote about things that happened over 500 years before they were born. If we accept that Mark was the first gospel that was written, and we will, I don't know where you sit on that, it doesn't matter for our point tonight. If we accept that Mark was the first gospel written, we're looking at someone who was an eyewitness who was writing approximately 30 years after the event. That's a lot less than 500. That's a very close amount of time. As we begin to look at who did the writing, what we find out is that they were far from biased to want to see the resurrected Christ. And certainly they were far from biased to want to write it down. You see, by the time John's writing his gospel, by the time Luke's writing his gospel, Christians are being persecuted because they believe in a resurrected Christ. I have to wonder what motivation John had to sit on the Isle of Patmos already in exile and write that beautiful scene that we have in Revelation chapter 4 and chapter 5 that all revolves around the resurrected Christ. What bias would lead him to that? He was already suffering. He was in the midst of suffering. He was going to suffer more. Why? Because of that testimony. Because of that testimony. And we know it wasn't just John. It was all of the apostles and many of the first century Christians that suffered because they believed in a resurrected Christ. By the way, N.T. Wright spends about 500 pages demonstrating that if they made up a legend, they had no source material. That as you examine Jewish and Greek writings from their time and before, this concept of the resurrection as it's presented in the gospel was an entirely fresh and new idea. That what is described going on with Jesus is not something that anybody in the first century would have ever thought, would have ever believed. And I ask you again, if you're trying to start some big movement in which you have some sort of standing and prestige, why would you begin by making up a story that no one would even understand why you would think happened? It really just doesn't make any sense. And again, I hope I repeat this enough that you remember it. No historical evidence can prove, in that post-Enlightenment sense of the idea of proof, no historical evidence can prove that any event occurred. I was reading along and I was thinking about this idea. These men died for what they said, and I found several people who said, so what? You know, there are people right now that will strap bombs on their chest and blow themselves up in the name of Allah. Should we believe in them? There are Buddhist monks who will set themselves on fire. Should we believe their testimony? So what if they're willing to hurt themselves? And I got to thinking about it. I said, wait, there's got to be more to that. And I finally found someone who kind of helped me put that together. And again, it was Gary Habermas. He says, extreme acts do not validate the truth of their beliefs, but willingness to die indicates that they regarded their beliefs as true. You know what? You're right. The simple fact that the apostles died because of what they believed doesn't prove that what they said happened. But it does prove that they believed that it did. Why else would they do it? Why else would they do it? But he goes on. And I think this is important. Moreover, there is an important difference between the apostle martyrs and those who die for their beliefs today. Modern martyrs act solely out of their trust and beliefs that others have taught them. The apostles died for holding to their own testimony that they had personally seen the risen Christ. Why should I believe Peter and not some Muslim who's blowing up city blocks in the name of Allah? I'll tell you why. Because Peter said, I saw it. And all that Muslim man can say is, my cleric said it. And he may believe everything the cleric said, but it's still just what the cleric said. Peter says, here's what I saw. I know there have been people that have been willing to go a long way to believe a lie and to lead others to believe it. But do you really believe there were 12 men? Not one or two or three. 12 men who claimed to have seen the risen Christ and who went to their death still claiming that one fact? Surely. Surely if they made it up. After two or three of them were put to death, the rest would have said, you know what, guys? This just isn't working out. We should tell the truth. It's not what happens. For the rest of the century, they're marched to fires and burned alive. Their heads are cut off. Spears are thrown into them. They're tortured to death. And they never recant. Not something someone told them, but something they claimed that they, with their own eyes, were able to see. The Gospels use unlikely witnesses. You might do a little reading about disposition towards women in the first century. The very fact that every gospel account says the women were the first to see the tomb makes it very unlikely that that's something they would have used if they were making this story up. Unlikely conversions. You know, go think about Paul and James. Paul's going to kill Christians. Why did he change? You know, something that's not deniable is that there was a man named Saul of Tarsus, that he was a Pharisee, that he was a persecutor of the church, and that he changed. Why did he change? James, who knew the Lord, he was his brother. He didn't believe him. He didn't see him as some coming Messiah. He didn't think he was the Son of God. He thought he was the son of a carpenter. Something changed his mind too. What was it that caused these men to change as they did? I'm running out of time, so I'm going to move on a little more quickly. So you think about all the various sightings of Christ, and you know, you pick one, and somebody's got an answer for it. Oh, they were just delusional. Oh, they were just hallucinating. Oh, you know, Paul was just having a guilt complex. James was just greedy. He wanted power. It makes no sense, but that's what they say. You know, the more elements I have to add into an explanation, the less likely that explanation is to hold up. You know, think about taking 10 quarters and flipping them and getting them all to land on heads. Can it happen? Statistically, there's a probability, yes. What are the odds? What are the odds? You see, the more elements that I add to an explanation, the less likely it is to hold up. You know, if you have to come up with 10 different explanations for that list in 1 Corinthians 15, you don't have a very good explanation. Your explanation becomes less likely than a resurrection. I think using these ideas is very fitting when we're talking to someone who is a skeptic of what we're talking about tonight, who doesn't believe in God, who doesn't believe that the resurrection was even possible. Well, what's the value of the discussion? Well, first of all, it requires an appeal to reason. Working logically through this process takes away what I believe to be the skeptic's strongest argument, and that is that Christians don't just use reason. And you know what? I can take reason, and I can prove that it is more likely that Jesus rose from the dead than it is that Jesus did not rise from the dead. And I think that's powerful and important for us to do as we try to convince people so that their souls can be saved. Anthony Flew, Bruce mentioned him this morning, he writes in the back of his book, There Is No God, which he scratches out, says there is a God. He writes in his appendix that to him, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the key to believing in Christ, God, because it shows God's interaction with man. It shows a loving, kind creator. I'll take it a step further than that. It gives parameters for that creation. You know, there's a couple of extremes. There's deism that says God just made us and doesn't care what's going on. And then there's this charismatic movement that says God's doing everything from saving my soul to giving me a good parking spot at Dillard's. I think both of them make a mockery of the God of the Bible. And I think I can use the resurrection and I can show a more consistent and sensible way in which our Creator interacts with this creation. And what I see is it is when there are monumental events that deal with the salvation of our souls. And boy, that opens the door for me to talk about what actually matters. This is important for us to talk about. I think it demonstrates a clear difference between Christianity in every other religion in the world. People ask me that a lot. Why should I believe what you believe and not what everybody else believes? Well, there's this little concept called falsifiability. And I don't necessarily agree with the position, but it's fairly popular. And that is that if you cannot in any way falsify a position, then you really have no way to prove your position. But here's the truth. Jesus either came out of that grave or He didn't. And if He didn't, I have no reason to believe in God. It doesn't matter if He's there because He cannot or will not do the things that He said He will do. My faith in your faith, as Paul says, is absolutely in vain. But if He did, if He came out and fulfilled all those Old Testament prophecies and demonstrated the power of God to give life, then friends, what logical person wouldn't appeal to that God? Wouldn't submit to that God? Wouldn't seek that God. I appreciate your time and attention. You've listened very well. I look forward to hearing Shane in just a moment.